The second file set for argument this morning is William Sweeney versus the South Dakota Board of Regents, University of South Dakota. Thomas Wilka will be arguing on behalf of Mr. Sweeney, and Anthony James Franken will be arguing on behalf of the Board of Regents. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Wilka, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed with your initial argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Franken, Mr. Healy, my name is Tom Wilka from Sioux Falls. I represent Dr. William J. Sweeney, who is a PhD at the University of South Dakota. He's been there approximately 30 years now. At the time all this began, it was 27 years of experience. He's a professor in the Graduate School of the School of Education, teaching special education, which in their vernacular and in the briefs is often referred to as SPED, S-P-E-D. And the thing about the three grievances that were filed and are before the court now is that they are separate cases which were consolidated together at the circuit court level on my motion so they could all be decided at the same time. And they can be, in your discretion, decided differently. You don't have to be unanimous about all three one way or the other because they are separate cases that have been appealed. And since they were consolidated at the circuit court level, they're consolidated now.
Counsel, can you clarify, and since time has passed, to make sure we're still on the same page or everyone as to the remedy that is being requested, particularly with regard to the latter two grievances? I understand with the first one, the request is to have the warning letter removed from his file. Is that's the remedy for that one, correct, that you're
correct,
requesting?
Your Honor.
But with the other two, it appears now with the second grievance that relates to the assignment of the undergraduate course that the remedy now is for overload compensation?
Yes, that's correct.
And then the third grievance, is the remedy still a request to, or tell me what the remedy is at this stage for the third grievance?
That the grievance should be sustained because he felt that he was treated very badly when that assignment was made on April 8, 2022, and that it was retaliatory. And it's important for him. I mean, it doesn't have to do with the removal of a letter from his file, but it would be known to the administration that his grievance was sustained by this court. Because they either violated the rules of the Board of Regents and of the University of South Dakota, or retaliated against Dr. Sweeney for filing the previous two grievances, or both.
Is he still seeking a rescission of those new workload assignments? That was the initial request for the third grievance.
It was. It's not in the record because it's happened since this appeal was filed, but the assignment that he was given to analyze the requirements of all 50 states of the various agencies that oversee special education teachers and professors has now been essentially discontinued. And that happened recently. And when it was first imposed on Dr. Sweeney, the explanation was that the Board of Regents in the University of South Dakota were under pressure from the federal government to have these jobs done, not just in the field of special education, but other specialty fields. And he did what he was told. I mean, he objected, he filed a grievance, he went through the whole process, he appealed the denial to circuit court, but he did what he was ordered to do. He felt that if he didn't do that, he would probably be discharged for insubordination.
So given your limited time here, I want to try to zero in on the claims with regard to the grievances. So for the first grievance, there were a couple matters that the circuit court remanded, and it appears those are no longer at issue on the improper advising claim with regard to the outdated forms or the waiver or substitution of courses. So that's no longer before the court. Agreed?
Those claims were dismissed. We feel like the evidence is still relevant to the issue of retaliation.
Okay, but I want to just focus on the first grievance at this point. So it appears to me that what is left with that one really hinges on whether or not there was inaccurate or improper advice given to the individual identified as RA. Is that really what that one boils down to at this stage?
He was also accused in the letter of advising students that were not assigned to him as advisees. And that gets into the whole debate and discussion about the definition of academic advising. And that centered upon RA. And in Dr. Sweeney's belief, that's what set the whole thing off, that Dr. Schweinle, his superior, was irate because he had told RA, you've exhausted all of the internal university procedures for getting a change in advisor. I suggest you talk to so-and-so, a lawyer in Vermilion that he knew. And all he did was refer to a lawyer, and that caused them to accuse him of improper advising, okay, well, even though there's no definition of advising in the...
And right now, what's before this court is what the board's findings and conclusions ultimately were in that grievance. And, you know, those seem to be focused on this advice given with regard to the Praxis Core examination. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts as to why, or your suggestion is that wasn't improper or incorrect advice.
It's our position he did not give inaccurate advice. And much of this is based upon this Exhibit B that wasn't made part of the record originally. I still don't know exactly why, but when I got the record, there was no Exhibit B. There was just a blank page with Exhibit B written on it. Subsequently, the court ordered that we supply that to the record, and we did, along with a less redacted copy of the same email. And in that email, he does not give, and it's RA who the email is to, even though her name is redacted out, he does not give her inaccurate advice. And I think the confusion or disagreement came from the fact that there are different Praxis tests that are required if you want to be certified to teach K-12. Certification is a function of a state statute, but people can get a master's degree in special education without getting a teacher certificate.
So it appears, at least from the Exhibit B, that RA was identified as a K-12 SPED student. So it appeared that at least that student was a student needing certification. Is that contrary to your understanding?
I could be wrong because our record is pretty voluminous by now with all three cases, but I don't think that's in the record. Mr. Franken may know otherwise.
It's listed on the by her signature on the email. It says K-12.
Oh, spec. Okay.
That's what I'm referring to.
She was not assigned to him as an advisee, and she was trying to get changed so that he would be her advisor. And that's why she came to him. But when he discusses the requirement for taking the Praxis multi-categorical test, he said you need to consult with your advisor about this.
Actually, the email doesn't refer to that in, with respect to that part of the email. But go ahead. I mean, it's pretty clear, at least from the exchange, that the position Dr. Sweeney was taking was a different one than what the division chair had told RA. So he had a dispute about that, and it appeared to me that his dispute was primarily based on his view of that not being in compliance with the past practice.
That's a big part of it, Your Honor. Yes. The second grievance, if I can get to that, is that he was given this new course to teach on short notice that he had never taught in 27 years with no discussion involved. And the third grievance also includes the claim on our part that there was no discussion, and the BOR policies require discussion. They don't require his agreement. For example, the last one, the April 8, 2022 assignment of this 50-state analysis didn't require his agreement, but the policies do require discussion. And, I mean, this is a university setting. And it's the regents that write the policies that require discussion, and there was no discussion on that last point, and there was no discussion in grievance number two about you are being assigned to teach this undergraduate course that you have never taught before. And he estimated that he put in 80 to 120 hours in December and January to get ready to teach it, when in fact he already had other things to do, of course. And to me, the analogy of this requirement of a discussion is a contract that has a mandatory mediation provision. And at first blush, you might say, well, why would they put that in there? Mediation's voluntary. The party could just come in and sit down after 5 minutes to say, I'm done. This is not going the way I like it. But I think the philosophy behind that is if you can get people together to talk about things, they might get things worked out. But you got to get them together in the first place. And that certainly is the philosophy that's reflected in the university policies, particularly 4.38.
So with regard to the second grievance, I mean, now, initially, there was a request that that assignment be rescinded. And now it's a request for overload compensation. So I'm trying to connect. So it appears the Board of Regents findings and conclusions agreed with the notion that there should be a discussion, but now I'm trying to connect that to the current remedy that is being sought for
well,
that.
Well, the 4.38 also says the workload credit should be a maximum of 30. And Dr. Sweeney submitted an explanation showing that his were somewhere between 33 and 40, hence the overload compensation issue. And at every stage of the grievance, the provost, with the president of the university, at the hearing, the Board of Regents never came up with a calculation of, no, here's how many credits you have. Originally, Dr. Schweinle responded with just a one-page table that said he was only getting 15 credits. Well, that makes no sense when, in fact, the expectation is 30, and there is no rationale in there given by her about why he would only have 15. And I think the record is pretty clear that Dr. Sweeney's evaluations for years were outstanding in all areas of teaching, research, and service. And they were the same year that this letter of warning was first issued, and they continued to be. I mean, he was an outstanding professor, and for whatever reason, Dr. Schweinle took a disliking to the way he does things, apparently, and this conversation with RA about here's a lawyer's name you can go talk to set her off. And now that we have Exhibit B in the record plus B2, which is the less redacted copy, which I requested once I saw the thing, it still has her name redacted, but it shows that email was originally sent to the university lawyer and to HR. Now, she has the right to send anything she wants to the lawyer, but it does reflect a sense of animosity toward Dr. Sweeney. I mean, this is a month before the letter of warning.
All right, you have just a few seconds remaining, Council, but I wanted to ask you about the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting analysis.
I don't think it fits. This is not a discrimination case, and the McDonnell-Douglas analysis comes from the fact that in most discrimination cases, there's no direct evidence of discrimination, and therefore, you have that three-part burden-shifting analysis of showing the prima facie case, the employer coming back with reasons, the employee then coming back with evidence of pretext. Well, that's not what is going on here. It's not a discrimination case at all. And I don't see how it's analogous.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkin. Mr. Franken, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. We're here before this court today over a disagreement between faculty member and the administration of the University of South Dakota over the appropriateness of three actions, each brought as a separate grievance and joined by the circuit court in appeal. I'll try to approach each one of those separately in the order in which they were grieved. The first grievance stems from the written warning of January 21 and an associated comment on Dr. Sweeney's evaluation. In its stipulated redacted form, that which was stipulated to upon remand, the warning advised Dr. Sweeney of two things. First, to immediately stop advising students who are not advised to Dr. Sweeney, and second, that advising must strictly adhere to Board of Regents, University and School of Education policies, procedures, and the university catalogs. In the end, this case is about the ability of the university administration to direct consistent information towards students about the requirements of admission and completion of its educational programs. Borrowing language from the South Dakota Administrative Procedures Act, the Board of Regents asserts that Dr. Sweeney has no legal right, duty, or privilege to engage in advising students of his choosing, and certainly not to give incorrect information about university policies or catalogs, as occurred in this instance. The incorrect information here is specifically about the requirement of the Praxis Core exam. Dr. Sweeney advised the student that there was no agreed upon policy regarding the Praxis Core exam and that the Praxis exam was a requirement of the undergraduate teacher education program, not the graduate program. This was incorrect or misleading. As to, there are multiple Praxis exams here, and yes, some of them are required for certification for teaching. However, if you specifically look at the admissions criteria of the university, the graduate catalog defines two categories of students, certified and non-certified. That refers to their certification for teaching activity. The graduate course catalog is clear that, quote, students who do not possess certification will need to have completed all of the admissions requirements for teacher education at the University of South Dakota. That statement creates a necessary cross-reference from the graduate catalog where that quote comes from, to the undergraduate catalog, which lists those requirements for teacher education admission. The admission requirements for undergraduate teacher education include passing the Core Academic Skills for Educators test, also known as the Praxis Core. The student in this case was thus correctly reminded by their assigned advisor that the student needed to complete the Praxis Core, and advised incorrectly by Dr. Sweeney that it was not a requirement. This obviously created confusion for the student. It was wholly appropriate for the Dean of the School of Education to issue a written warning that Dr. Sweeney should only advise students assigned to him and that advising must follow these policies and catalogs. Advice must accurately represent the admission standards of the university. The university asserts that this language in the catalog is clear and unambiguous, and the warning was an appropriate method of ensuring, one, that the School of Education knew who was providing information to students about program requirements, and two, ensuring that that information was correct.
Was there any indication, at least from the record, other than how this particular student was identified in the email, that this was not a student needing certification?
It is unclear whether the student needed certification for their career goal, but it does not appear that this student was certified at the time they were applying to school. Now, I should clarify just to process these. A student may also be granted provisional admission or conditional admission. You meet most of the requirements and you're named a student, but you've got some additional things to take care of before you're fully in and complete the program. And so the advice given here, and if you look at the email exchange in Exhibit B, it looks like it is referring back to those undergraduate. You have to pass all of the admissions requirements for the undergraduate program, and that was correct advice. It was a requirement for the graduate program to meet all those undergraduate requirements for admission. There's no policy that specifically defines advising, but I think at the core of advising is ensuring that students understand and complete the steps necessary to earn their degree. This is in line with Dr. Dean Schweinle's interpretation of advising and Provost Kurt Hackamer's interpretation of advising, and that interpretation was upheld by the Board of Regents in this case. Rejecting the Board of Regents' interpretation of the term advising and cloaking this activity with a broad protection of academic freedom would seriously undermine the university's abilities to consistently and efficiently communicate its program requirements with students.
You've mentioned that a couple of times, theme kind of running through the submissions also. Are you suggesting that in some way our standard review should reflect a degree of deference to the university in terms of how it applies or interprets the Board of Regents policies, how it conducts its evaluations of its professors, that sort of thing?
So I think when you look at this particular issue, when we're really diving into what is the requirements for the educational program, that should be given deference. Now, I don't know where the court is going generally with agency deference of interpretation, but if you look at the South Dakota Administrative Procedures Act, the legislature has indicated some degree of deference or setting aside of student academic matters. They're excluded from the contested case definition, and really when it comes down to it, the degree requirements are an issue between students and the Board of Regents as to what it is required of a student as an academic matter to complete the program and get a degree.
So, for instance, I don't want to jump ahead, but to the second grievance and also the third grievance, and both focusing on provisions that require consultation with faculty, and really the difference in interpretation, whether this is a more intimate one-on-one consultation or a more broad consultation that an institution undertakes with its faculty in a plural sense. Do we review that interpretation de novo or not? Do we just look at the text and read it like we would read a statute or a contract or a regulation, or...
So I think you can look at the text. The language with regard to consultation as to assignments, it says that discussion should occur during the annual evaluations. Now there's an urging to have that conversation, that discussion during the evaluations. One problem with that, as it can't be seen as a hard requirement, so to speak, is that the annual evaluations happen at a fixed time in the year, generally during the winter time. Courses change. There are retirements. There are faculty that leave. There are more students that sign up for a course. So changes necessarily have to happen after the event, annual evaluation. And so setting it and fixing it there. Also, it is a discussion, but it is not a negotiation. And that was a bit of tension, I think, in this, is that there was a view that the assignments were up for negotiation. I hadn't had a type of assignment like this in the past, and so I shouldn't have it now. Moving into the second grievance, I think when you can look at issues of interpretation, but really the second grievance centers around a burden of proof. Under the grievance policy, Dr. Sweeney bears that burden of proving that there was a policy violation. And the parties started off reading from different pages here. Dr. Sweeney came forward with this grievance in the first instance saying the university's workload policy was not properly adopted. He carried that through the next steps, and it wasn't until the parties were before the hearing examiner that it was admitted, yes, the workload policy was properly adopted. Yet Dr. Sweeney continued to rely on the calculations that he made using the old policies. You'll see his references going back to his self-evaluation, and those calculations that are pointed out through the steps of this, they start on page 132 of the record there. They state that they are based upon the May 2008 School of Education workload policy and the 2006 USD workload policies. They just simply were not applying the right math. The circuit court pointed out some of those differences and stated Dr. Sweeney's submission to this court cite no authority for his calculations. In attempting to bear the burden of proof here, he wasn't applying the right policy to show that the teaching workload had gone beyond some type of limit.
It seemed like a lot of his calculations, though, were also, and I understand, and you did some math in your brief to show how some of those, you know, would not apply to the current workload policy. But it seemed like, you know, in a bigger scope, or at least what amounted to more of the credits, he argued he should have been that should have been recognized related to the things where the policy has discretion to afford if there is a disproportionate amount of work that a particular faculty member is doing, that it has some of those things built into it where, in his view, in the past, he had been credited for things like that and was not, that was not included in the dean's calculation.
So I think past practice shouldn't really be applied here because you aren't looking at past practice to interpret the same policy. It is a new policy. The Board of Regents had moved away from a union negotiated agreement that set its policies for workload. It was setting forth a new policy, and there's a certain degree of flexibility in the workload policy itself. It is stated as a statement of faculty expectations. You'll see terms in there such as equivalent and ordinarily a workload unit would represent 3 hours per week. But there's a lot of flexibility because of the range of activities. Even looking at the activities which are engaged in by Dr. Sweeney, if you look to the testimony, you look to the advising of dissertation students. Now, normally, they finish under one timeline, and he was asked about the expectation on when those would finish up. It looked like his students were finishing along a little bit slower path. So the work may not have been as intense. And in the evaluation process, that's when it really looks on quantity and quality, when quantity is sometimes hard to judge, especially when you get outside of the teaching category into service category. You don't know how many times a committee is going to meet sometimes. Yeah, you don't know what a student organization, how active it's going to be.
So in my understanding, that Dean Schweinle's calculations was just his teaching workload. It didn't, the 15.5 didn't include whatever credit he might have for service or research. But it looked like to me from his own calculations, that was another four or five maybe additional credits, which I don't know that those were even in dispute. It seems like this is really about what the teaching workload calculation is.
It is really about the teaching workload calculation there. The service and research, those are really flexible. Again, it's you're evaluated at the end about that. And so your research project, you may, you know, you might have a research project that's going on that that takes up a lot of time or a little time. It's pretty flexible there.
So before you run out of time, I just wanted to address the third grievance, a retaliation claim.
Sure.
And, you know, I think it appears that Dr. Sweeney's, you know, his main focus appears to be some of the statements in President Gestring's letter.
Sure.
in that part of the grievance procedure. And the reference to his the prior, or I think it was referred to as an ongoing concern about continued improper advising or advising of students not assigned to him. Was that enough to at least show a causal, the prima facie showing to get into the later burden shifting if we determine that that applies? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I don't think so. There was an ongoing concern. It's unresolved on who Dr. Sweeney could talk to about what. And that is about the efficient administration of the university. Also, I would just say, Dr. Schweinle clearly laid out that he had a lot of qualifications for this specific job. And when Dr. Sweeney was asked who could better do it, he was unable to name another person within the School of Education. And I think that's really important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Franken. Mr. Wilka, you can proceed with rebuttal.
First of all, Your Honor, in Exhibit B, at the end of the third paragraph, in the beginning of the paragraph, Dr. Sweeney's talking to this student about equivalency of different courses, and he ends it with, whether the undergraduate courses you took meet this requirement is an issue for your advisor. That's what I was referring to earlier, that he told her to do that. Mr. Franken at the beginning said that the letter of warning was redacted by the stipulation. I don't agree with that. I've never seen a redacted version of that same letter. Those issues were dismissed, and that's explicitly what the order signed by Judge Byrne says when she adopted the stipulation that we signed. Essentially, the parties wanted to move on and not go back and reopen the evidentiary hearing so that Mr. Tellinghuesen could make more findings. And so those two allegations were dismissed. But the letter of warning is still in the file in its original form. It's not redacted. Dr. Sweeney never claimed he had a right to give advice to anybody, but he did say that it is not academic advising for me to tell this young graduate student, you've exhausted university procedures, go talk to a lawyer. And here's one in Vermilion I know. That is not academic advising and is certainly not a proper source of discipline. The other thing that was going on in the first letter was Dr. Schweinle was absolutely mistaken that they had moved to a single advisor system. And that was not the case. And the evidence proved it. Exhibit 6 in the first grievance record shows that. And at the evidentiary hearing, Dr. Hackamer admitted that was a mistake because the professors that were advising students that had 2 and 3 year programs were still advising those people. It was just the new students that were going to be advised by a single person. And the thing that they did, that we think is certainly subject to de novo review is that they would add words and phrases to the different policies to reach the result that they wanted. Well, that's just a point of statutory interpretation, which these policies are subject to the same rules. And that's where they came up with some of these consultation means with the faculty as a whole. It doesn't say that. That was added during the course of the grievance. They also, when they, the policy talks about there should be consultation about these assignments, they interpreted that to mean the same as may. That it's, in my view, should is closer to shall than may. And should, and we cite a case like this in our brief, is inherently ambiguous, and therefore past practice is relevant to clear up that ambiguity. I don't think you give deference to the agency's interpretation of its own policies. I think the Chevron-type deference is gone based on what the U.S. Supreme Court said. The other thing about retaliation was not just what President Gestring said in her final step letter about if you can't do this, you don't know enough to teach young people. And she brought up for the first time since the first grievance a concern about advising people not assigned to them. That had not been mentioned once during the entire second grievance process, had not been mentioned at all in the first two steps of the third grievance process. But the key is, in her testimony, Dr. Swinely, when asked, why didn't you discuss this with him, one of her reasons given was because he filed the previous grievances. I mean, she says that right in the transcript, because you filed the previous grievances. That, to me, is direct evidence of retaliation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkins. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We originally had a third case set for argument this morning, and we were advised by the parties on Monday that case is settled. So our calendar for the rest of the day, or for oral argument, is concluded. With that, we'll be in recess.